are at Harry Crawley's home. The name of the person I'm interviewing is Harry Crawley, and my name is Rebecca Jane Ross Williams, and I'm here to interview Harry as part of the Cruel Sea Project. This project is in partnership with Liverpool Everyman and Playhouse, Age Exchange, Liverpool Culture Company and Age Concern Liverpool. Cruel Sea has been a national reminiscence project focusing on World War II Merchant Navy veterans. This project is continuing the research with Merchant Navy veterans and their families. With permission, we are recording this interview on video camera and on mini disc. The material will be archived in Liverpool on the Isle of Man. As part of this project, we're planning to create a theatre production. Permission will be sought from Harry for use of the material beyond it being archived. So, Harry, can you tell me where you grew up as a boy?
Well, I was born in Ballymadrill, Arbury. I went to Arbury School. We moved from that down into the village itself, and I went to Arbury School till I was 11, and then I got a scholarship for Douglas High School, which meant that I had to get the first train in the morning. That was what a dollar beg would be. Past seven. Luckily, it was 25 to 8. Well, I don't think the trains were that fast then either, but it would be a bit later than that, which meant that I had to be at the station in time for it. Which, well, about half a mile's walk. It was nothing to us then. And went to the high school, which meant you didn't get home till 5:30 in the evening. Had your meal, and then you had three subjects, homework to do, and that went on till I got to fifth form. And unfortunately, in first term of fifth form, an epidemic of mumps went around. Well, unfortunately, I got the full value, and it kept me off for a month or so, and it put me to out of the running for the matriculation exam at the end of the school year. And I applied to the Isle of Man Steam Packet Company for an apprenticeship, and I was accepted, luckily, and it's hard to get jobs in 1936.
How old were you then?
16. And I went to see Mr. Kelly, the superintendent engineer, for an interview. And first thing he said to me, I sailed with your grandfather. And anyhow, that must have been one entry term scored. Anyhow, I got the job. And our first year, we were living in Port St. Mary then, at the Four Roads. We moved from Ballybeg into Port St. Mary. And for the first year of my apprenticeship, I was allowed to start at 8:30, because there was no bus got in, or train got into Douglas before 8:30 in the morning. For the second year, I had to get in at 7:30. So I had to buy a motorcycle. The first one I had was a 500cc Rudge. And it was a good bike, but unfortunately it was getting on a bit. And in my second year, 1937, I dropped a valve in the engine going down Richmond Hill, and that put the finishing to the Rudge.
Harry, what did you do for your first year as an apprenticeship?
Well, I started off, as they all did at that time, in the tinsmith shop. And the first job I was given, was to make paint pots out of 16th gauge sheet metal. That was a good job, but there was no, you had to make good tight joints and all that, and because they weren't soldered or anything, they had to be tight enough to hold paint. Mm-hmm. And my word, after my first day there, my hands were blistered. Oh. And then it went on, you were making what they call duck lamps. They were looked like a, oh dear, how would I describe that? Almost like a teapot with a straight spout.
Okay.
Which you put an asbestos wick down, and it filled it with colza oil and burned colza. The duck lamps were in the oil burning ships in the boiler room, so you could light the torches, yeah, for the fires. And they were made of nice tin soldered joints and everything. I became quite good at soldering and making these things. And there were other jobs you had to do, help out the old tinsmith. My word, he was a tradesman too. And one of the jobs you had to do for him was go up. I can't remember the name of the tobacconist up at the top of Victoria Street in Douglas. It's gone now. There's another sort of shop on the corner. But to buy him an ounce of twist tobacco. Because of his pipe. And he'd be making such things as galley funnels and chimney. I can call them nothing else but chimney pots. The H type, they were very good because they couldn't get a downdraft down the funnel. Mm-hmm. But oh golly, I can't remember all I had to do there. But then towards the end of the first year, was into the fitting shop, and you got all the small jobs to do. Drill this, drill that, and drill the other. And the drills they were using were old wing-type drills. If you broke one, you went to the blacksmith and you said, will you flatten this out? It's a 5/16 drill I want to finish with. So he'd flatten it out for you, and you'd go in and grind it on the old sandstone, big sandstone, the right size, then you go back and he would temper it for you. You go and start all over again. Uh-huh. And they went up to some quite big drills. It was a real red letter day if they allowed you to use a twist drill. It was taken out of a locked drawer and given to you. And that was same applied to the fitters that were there. Golly.
In the fitting shop, was that for all different things for the ship?
The lathes, drills, planing machines. Yeah. And there was a blacksmith shop too, adjoining it. And they did a lot of blacksmith work, and they had a steam hammer in there. Between the two, there was an old Lancashire boiler. And the alongside that was a gas engine. That drove the way shaft for the machines in the shop. They're all belt driven. And also it supplied power to the, to the laundry, which is alongside the shop again. Well, they were magnificent laundresses. They could shrink a wool blanket down to next to nothing. But that was another job for the apprentices. In the washing machines, they were long cylindrical things. They had wooden pegs inside them. And when these pegs got worn down with the use and water and all that, small apprentice had to go inside and replace them. They had to shut the sliding door on you if you wanted to move around for the next. Oh, fun. the second year, went on much the same. We had to go out with the fitters when the ships came in with a rush job on. But I went on to the first lathe that the steam packet that had the apprentices using. It was one they'd bought from the Gellings Foundry after the First World War. And it was only a plane turning machine, it wasn't a screw cutting one. But you got jobs, you'd be turning out piston rings for the pumps on board ship from quills, cast iron quills. Turning out valve spindles, which were passed on to the other two screw turn, the other two lathes that were screw cut. The worst of the job was you got big cast iron wheels for the trolleys in the cargo shed. You had to bore those out. Oh gosh. Sometimes, as a Gellings Foundry, you sometimes got a ball bearing in and that lathe tools wouldn't touch that. Just put over it. That was great.
How long was the apprenticeship?
It was 5 years, actually. Oh. And the Rudge motorcycle went to the scrapyard, I got a 1932 KTS Velocet 350, beautiful machine it was, and during that year it was 37, 36 or 37. The old superintendent, the retired superintendent engineer, died, and the whole fitting shop was given the afternoon off, and they were expected to attend the funeral. So I went home early, got changed to go to church, and got on the bike and back to Douglas again. And then I joined I think Tommy Cannell was with us, I'm not sure that time. Morris Holden, he's out in Canada at the present moment, near Tommy in Vancouver. And Stanley Burden, no, Tommy Cannell wasn't with us, he couldn't get in. Stanley had Austin Mini, no, not 1930s Mini. So we all piled into his car, half up to St. Ninian's Church. And the first part of the service, we were known as a coffin going into two churches on the way to the grave, but there. And then we went to Kirklonan Church, which because J.R. Kelly had been a church warden there and a great member of the church. Then he was interred, and I remember we all going past the coffin, looking down, dropping a bit of sand in. Afterwards, I could hear them saying, "Oh, he was older than that, you know." Well, that'll be for the insurance. So then we went off down to Ramsey to see Morris's cousin. Well, we'd met her at a Christmas party we had in Morris's house. And that's when Tommy Cannell met his wife, and he never went out with another girl in his life, and he's still with her. And we just said hello to her, and then had to set off back. It was Friday, get back in Douglas in time to get paid. Mm. Well, golly, what we were getting. Second year, 11 shillings a week. They docked 10 pence off for what is now called national insurance.
Mm.
So we had to dash back over the mountain on the TT course. And we're going along as fast as he dared go. And the Morris was driving. No, it wasn't Stanley Burton's car. It was his brother-in-law's car. Oh, gosh, I remember. Oh, I can't go any further. This is George's car, you know, faster. And as the car passed us, going like the clappers, and Billy Crane was another apprentice sitting in the back, saying, Glarus, go harder, I can't. Anyhow, we got to Douglas and they, in time for the get payout. That was all right, and then I all dispersed and went home. And used to meet Billy Crane and Morris on a Saturday night in Douglas. We'd go to the pictures then, and that was about all we could do with the money we were getting. We couldn't afford anything else. And that's all we do.
Harry, can I ask you a question? If the apprenticeship was normally 5 years...
5 years, yeah.
Then during the apprenticeship, you wouldn't normally go to sea?
No. No, we didn't.
But because of the war...
Well, because of the war, we went to sea.
You went to sea before the end of your apprenticeship?
Yes, I'm still an apprentice, though.
So how did that happen? What happened?
Well, I went up to see Mr. Moore, R.B. Moore, who was the superintendent engineer then, and he was a jolly good man, he was, really. And I said, Mr. Moore, is there any chance of me going to sea? Because, well, I said, I don't want to be called up. And he said, well, I'll think about it. And not long after that, he sent for me and he said, you want the third engineer for the Russian castle? And there were only three engineers on that. And he said, I want you to go third. Well, it was rather funny. Mr. Kane was chief engineer. He was a very hard man. And Charlie Kelly was second with him. And it was always a bit of a go on with him and the two of them. And, well, he was very good to me. He was Kane, really, at that time. He was very good. And it was right. I was left down below. Well, after he left Douglas Head till we got to the bar and able to keep an eye on things, tell when bottom ends were going up. She was a reciprocating job. You had to put your hand in. And if anybody had left a bit of a brass liner out on the bottom end, they caught you, didn't you? But they were all pretty good fitters and they didn't leave much out. And
can we just go back a second? When you asked him if you could go on the boat and he said you could be the third engineer, how much notice did you have before you had to catch the boat?
Oh, the boat was going every other day in Douglas. She was on the Liverpool Douglas service and vice versa. And she wasn't going anywhere. She was built in 1894.
Yeah.
I think that was the age. A reciprocating job, and she was a beautiful engine. No doubt about that. Went there.
Had you been out to sea on a boat before?
Not a sailing, we've been on passenger runs, you know.
Yeah.
I remember going to Dublin on a day trip to Dublin with some of the other apprentices on the Mona's Queen. Of course, she was the number one ship that they were looking at then, because she was built in 1933, and she had the first ship to have water tube boilers. So we were down below, and Bob O'Neill, the second engineer, a big man, tall man, but my word, he was good. He gave us a good show around the engine room and a bit of a lecture and all that. It was good.
What did he lecture you?
On ships and ships' engines.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the general things about a ship's engine room and what you need to look out for.
So what was your, can you explain what you actually did as the third engineer? What did he tell you you had to do?
Well, just keep they covered it very nicely then. You just keep a watch, and that meant you kept the watch on all the machinery that was going around you.
That's big job, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And that was a good day out, but we didn't, we wanted to know why. The only other one I went was a midnight trip to Liverpool. Old Joe Creer, he was, Joe Simpson, rather. He was a greaser, but he took me in hand, the young fella, you know. Mm. And we were going to the Liverpool-Everton football match, actually. So he looked after me for the day. He turned out to be a jolly good fella. He was one of the two that took Roy Motion in hand when he was wounded and on the beach in Dunkirk. Oh, yes. That's the sort of man he was.
Mm. So your first trip, where did the ship go to?
It was Liverpool, Douglas.
From Douglas to Liverpool?
Yeah, and yes, then back every day. One day you went to Douglas, Liverpool, next day you come back to Douglas. And I don't know what other ship at the time was doing the alternative runs with us. It wasn't Snaefell who did the rest of the war. I forget. But it was good. I learned quite a bit there. Two good greasers, two old men, they've been in ships all their lives. And I was told while I was in the fitting shop, if one of the firemen or greasers says something to you about some machinery or what something you're doing, take notice of him, because he's seen other engineers do that same job and he might see a better way of doing it than you're doing it. Just listen to them. And it was a good advice, and I never ignored it all the time. It always weighed up. Anyhow,
in the trip that used to go from Douglas to Liverpool, what size crew was it, do you think?
Well, the crew, I would like to say, now let me think. There were three greasers. Only one watcher fireman. One, two, three, four. There'd be four firemen. Mm. One double ender's boiler, so there's two to each boiler. Four, that was seven. Three engineers, 10. The crew, deck crew, I'm not too sure of how many are there. I never took that much notice. 3, 6, 7, 8. There'll be about eight of a crew, maybe more, eight of a seamen. Mm. And the stewards and stewardesses, be three stewardesses, one, two, be about six stewards, because there'd be six, maybe five stewards, because you had a steward down below in the steerage. Three in the, so the other in the first class, that's three. Yes, three stewards and two, there's five in the stewarding department, plus one, two barmen, and another two cooks, let me think. Oh, the cook and his assistant, yes, two cooks, and three galley boys.
And when, so that would take passengers from Douglas to Liverpool.
Yes.
And then it turned round and come back home.
Yeah.
So were you able to stay at home at night?
No. Every other night.
Right.
Yes. Spent the one night in Liverpool.
Right. How long was the crossing?
4 hours.
Right.
Sometimes more.
And then how long would you stay there before coming back?
You'd stay overnight in Liverpool.
Yeah.
In those days, they weren't allowed to stay alongside the landing stage. You went up the river about Camel Lairds and anchored there for the night. And the Liverpool stewards and stewardesses were lucky. They got a ferry ashore. It was the coal barge that came out to top up the bunkers.
Yes.
And they'd go ashore on with the coal barge.
Wow. So what changed for you from doing this? So you were doing the trip from Douglas to Liverpool, yes. And Liverpool to Douglas, and then what happened?
And what do you mean, what happened then?
What changed? What was your next journey that was different from then?
Well, at the end of the Christmas week, Harvey Morris said for me, the Mourner's Isle is paid off from the White Ensign, and Arthur Corkle is short of a job now. Because there were a lot of spares, because then, when ships were paid off from the Navy, you see. And anyhow, Arthur took my place. I was a funny man with a second engineer's ticket, and I picked my place as third engineer. And he said, I want you to go up to the Barrow and join the Snaefell, fourth engineer. That was a horrible job, fourth engineer. And I'd been to Manchester once. I had an uncle, Manx uncle, my father's brother, who lived in Manchester. And my aunt came down to meet me at the landing stage and took me up to Manchester. That's the furthest I'd ever been away from home before that. Anyhow, I got across, got the train to Barrow. That was good. You had to change at Lancaster. Mm-hmm. So I think it was Lancaster. And I arrived in Barrow in the blackout. And I got a taxi down to the Snaefell and found it in the blackout, because he dropped me at the high level bridge in Barrow, down the steps and down the fine witches of the ships that tied up there. And seen the chief engineer, Cyril Watterson, and he said to me, you've got to go back in the morning. So I had to get up early and got the first train out of Barrow. So I didn't see anything of Barrow. It was still dark when I left it.
Why did he say you had to go back?
He back to Douglas, and I had to join the Tynwald. She was up at the Tongue in Douglas, top of the harbour, as the yacht marina now. And she's just finishing her overhaul, because she'd come back from trooping. It had been the time then, when there was no real movement on either fronts, no real war had started, the phony war. And I was going as a junior engineer on her. So that was all right. I learned a lot while I was there, because John Collister was second engineer. And he was very keen on the weir's pumps. They had to be perfect. So I had to learn how to take a shuttle valve adrift and make it better, tie it up, put liners in behind the slide valve and all that.
Was this as fourth engineer on this?
Oh, no, I wasn't fourth. I was about to, let me see, the seventh, the seven there. Second and a third. Yes, I would be the sixth or seventh anyhow. There's only six of us. Seven, yes, because the chief engineer, he didn't keep watch. And we were doing four on, four off watches. So we went down to Southampton. And there too, we were outsiders. We were lying for a long time down at anchor opposite, oh dear, dear. My memory, the military hospital.
Okay.
Right down the quite well down. It was very rarely we got up alongside unless they wanted us to come up and take soldiers on. Well, then we went to Le Havre or Cherbourg. Mm-hmm. Then, because the Southern Railway were the big boys down there then.
Oh. What month was this?
That was January
of 1940. I just stop you 1 second, Harry. Is there enough light, Jackie? Because now he's going to talk about the French experience. It might be because it's getting darker.
Uh-huh. Put the aspirin lights on. You'll get a bit brighter there. The energy saving ones. They come up at 60 watt.
So Harry, if we can go from going to Cherbourg.
Yes. Yeah. Le Havre and Cherbourg. We didn't get to ashore much in Cherbourg. We were ashore one or two nights in Le Havre, but it was black out there too. It was nothing much. Up to a cafe and have a few glasses of wine and then come back. So that was very quiet. Running over to Cherbourg and Southampton and Le Havre. And the Sarcelles, the Finella, the Ben McCree, Lady Man.
Can you spell the name of the boat you were on?
Tynwald.
Yeah, is it
Tynwald.
Harry, can you tell us about that experience of arriving there and seeing Ben McCree and the other boats and what happened?
Well, there it's... we did this trooping until we were called up for Dunkirk. A nice, easy life for us. And up to Dunkirk. And going up along the land, well, we went to Dover first and then got Dover Roads, then got our orders. And there was a swept channel through the minefields there. And you went out and took a right-hand turn, a left-hand turn when you got to the French coast. That's the best way I can put it now. And actually, you're going up there, you could see a black smoke here, there and everywhere, and you could hear guns firing. And then when we got up to Dunkirk, well, the oil tanks were afire there, and it's part of the town as well. So we went up, and as I said before, we had to hang about until it was your turn to go in and take into the jetty and embark troops. Well, it was a bit awkward there because there was a concrete handrail or rails going down alongside the jetty, and you couldn't get gangways out. So luckily there were some very good heavy sledgehammers on board ship. They went to work on that and smashed the concrete down till they could get a gangway out. And the boys just, they came ashore and they were crammed like sardines. They were really crammed. And back to Dover with them. And you disembarked them and then off again back to Dunkirk. And after the third run, it's less the time. Oh no, before that, the owner's queen, we hadn't seen her. She'd been up round Dover, and she'd done a lot of the evacuations from the Belgian coast. Mm. And the tale I was told afterwards that fourth engineer. I can see his face, and his name will come to me just now. Lacey. Lacey, I can't just remember. But he was on watch, and the second engineer came down and said, go on up and have a look at this, Lacey. We've never seen anything like this. And when Lacey Knowles was up on deck, that's when the mine got her. And he was the only engineer that survived. Two of the chaps that were in the fitting shop when I was apprentice, one was the senior apprentice, George Kenyuk, and the other was Bob Collister, he was a turner in the shop. They were just waiting to go on watch on the Mona's Queen, and they were sitting in the galley, just waiting to be called for relief when she got it. And some of the sailors had told me that survived, but all the engineers lost their lives, bar those two, bar Lacey. And it's a horrible thing. It just shows you what chances the engineers had, and all the below crowd and watch at the time never got out of it either. And we didn't know at the time that it was the Mona's Queen. It was a long time afterwards before we learned it was the Queen, and they learned from back from Douglas. So. Then when we went out, we passed the Fenella going in, and as I told you, on the way back, she was still there. And that's when I got into trouble for saying she was sunk.
Did everybody have to go so slow, because there was only a certain number of ships that could go in?
You could only get two at the seaside of the jetty, because we had to go in past the Mona's Queen, past the Fenella, and more up top of her. And the shells were landing on the base of the jetty at the time. Yeah. Other than that, we had been inside in the harbour part. And I thought that I was on deck, and there was a dive bomber chasing a destroyer across the front of the harbour entrance. I thought, my God, if he gets it where it's trapped in here. But luckily he missed. The bomb missed. You could see the bomb coming down.
So they were targeting the destroyers rather than the merchant ships?
They targeted the destroyers more so than the merchant navy ships.
But merchant navy ships could be accidentally...
Well, they could accidentally get it. Well, he must have been going for the ships in the harbour when... The Fenella got it, but that's the ship taking troops on board.
Yeah.
See, that was it.
Tell me about when you saw the Fenella. How did you know it was being sunk?
Well, I could see the lifeboat davits out on the port side, and no lifeboat in it, and I could see that the water was up the level of the shelter deck. Mm. That was about what? Oof. 9-10 feet lower down than she should have been. Yeah. And that was, she was sitting upright.
Yeah.
And, she had a good hole in her side. Well, it had to be a good hole to sink her. And to break into the engine room and damage here in there, because as I say, it was a bit of the oil cooler door that hit Roy Motion on the leg.
Harry, when the boats were having to wait and to go so slowly, what did the men do on the ship? Because there must have been a sense of stress.
Well, there was stress, all right, because the bombers were around, and as I say, they were more inclined to go after destroyers. And there were other merchant ships sunk. There was one sunk, or beached away from, I don't know which one it was, but it was too far away. Oh, they got some merchant ships. And when Crested Eagle was gone, you see, she was Thames Ferry, or Medway Ferries, or whatever they were.
So what did the men do to handle the stress?
I don't know what we did. It played on the nerves and lack of sleep, because it was in and out, and you didn't get much sleep when you were off watch either. Again, I suppose stress. What, you get up and see what was happening.
Oh, so the men didn't get sleep because there had to be more people on watch, and there was
yes, they were on watch. Yeah. Again, they'd, and it didn't take long. You see, it was what, 2.5-3 hours at the most. The way we went, it's only when you wait, so from Cali to Dover, it's only about 3/4 of an hour at the most. Nowadays, it's much less than that. So it wouldn't be much further to Dunkirk, except the course we had to take.
Yeah.
No use trying to take a shortcut through a minefield.
Yeah. What were you actually doing during that time?
Well, on watch, off watch, trying to get a bit of sleep and help see if we're getting near Dunkirk now. And
how many men would be on watch?
Down below, two engineers, three greasers, that's engine room hands, and three firemen in the boiler room, a leading hand and two firemen. And they were four on, four off, since we were, that's the engineers, but they were a good crowd too.
Can you remember, were there any characters that you remember clearly from
that? Well, characters there, let me see. Arthur Cowley, he was a greaser, no, a real gentleman, manxman. Came from a Laxey family. His brother was also a greaser on one of the vessels. A cousin was a seaman. But he was good, and he was better than a lot of engineers that I knew. Jolly sight better. He was capable. He'd do. Oh, and I forgot. There was one more, Arthur. Oh, dear. Gosh, I can't think of the surname. It'll come to me now. The Donkeyman. He was an excellent man. Gosh, he was. On peacetime, the donkeyman in the steam packet would get the engines all ready for going. Yeah, open up steam on the engines and all that, get the boilers up. Sometimes he had a bit of help from the fourth engineer, and Oh dear. I just can't think of his surname. You see his face too, but he was good. They were all very good and capable men. They didn't have to be told what to do. They knew what to do. And life got a lot different after the war when they got crowds that claimed to have been deep sea men. They'd never learned enough to clean a boiler. Boiler burner. I had a couple on the Manxman when I was second engineer. And one fellow, oh God, he knew it all. But my word, he was lazy. The other fellow, he had a good hand, only fond of drink. Very drink. He missed a trip. And he lived in Pudleyan. He came back. His face was scratched. Oh, where were you yesterday? How did you miss a trip? Well, he said he got home. Got home when he was full. When he got home, the wife tore into him. She had a fight with the wife. See, that's what the scratches were. So he had to stay behind and make peace. So on the passage, he said to me, I'll go behind the after boiler sack and do a bit of painting there. Needed it too, really. I said, there's no point in doing that. It's red hot behind there. Oh, that's all right, he said. It'll sweat some of the ale out of me. And he got on with it. And you can forgive a man like that. But the other fella, after I retired, and the leading hand was Alfie Kringle, damn good leading hand he was too, and he used to do most of the work for them. In the morning, he'd go down and clean the boiler, the furnace of the only two boilers on the Manxton, because she was the first superheat boiler job they had. And he'd clean the burners. Well, they sat down in the forecastle until they had to come down. But when Alfie retired, I wasn't there then, I'd left. They made him leading hand. And he didn't even know how to clean a burner. He'd been all his life at sea. And that leading hand job there was different to the others, because the leading hand controlled the speed of the fans. They were pressurized boiler room, so that the air came through in two big vents. Blooming cold in the winter time too, you had to dodge away from that. The fans were controlled by an air pressure trigger, and the triggers were up in the fan room, leading hands down in the boiler room, and he's got a little trigger to press here. You know, I had to get the right speed, because otherwise you got smoke. She smoked like anything. I don't know how he got on with that, but.
Going back to Dunkirk, if you were to try and explain the horror of it, what's the worst memory that you have of it, the worst memory really
was the shells landing on the end of the jetty, just on the landward a little bit, but you could see the landing. That wasn't very handy. If they got the range, they get coming in closer every day. And again, horror. Maybe I was too young to be horrified, I don't know. And I didn't realize I was. But we were in the harbor part. One time loading, and Thomas Kane, DSO, was mate of the ship. He'd been a lieutenant R&R in the First World War on cruise ships. That's how he got his DSO. But it must have been pretty near the end, because we were loading French troops. And old Tommy was up on the beach with nine tube in his hand, he's waving this and he's shouting, feet, feet, feet. And they got them on board. They didn't need to be told to hurry, they were hurrying.
Yeah.
And we got on board a spaniel, Dunkirk. Oh, poor thing, frightened and all that. And Tommy took care of that, and he brought it home. And unfortunately, he had the dog on the hills there, up at the chasms. Well, the chasms are cliffs and they're split inland. They were a great tourist attraction at one time. And poor old dog chased a gull and didn't stop at the edge and went over. And so quite a long drop down to the beach. And that was the finish of it. But Tommy, he was a good mate. He was a bit temperamental. But he was a good man.
So the man was shouting Veet on the beach and getting everybody on.
Veet, Veet. Hurry up.
Yeah.
I can almost remember my French from high school.
And you did manage to get everybody on the boat?
Oh, yes. We got all on the boat as much as we could carry.
Yeah.
They were absolutely jammed tight. if anything had happened, they would never have got up from the lower lounges, you know, these stairs, where they were sitting on stairs and all that jam. You got as many as you possibly could. There was no such thing as Board of Trade rules and regulations.
Yeah. So that was in January 1970?
No, that was in May.
In May. So between January and June, you kept doing the same trip to Dunkirk?
Yeah, between January and June, first of all, we were trooping from Southampton to Cherbourg and Le Havre.
Yeah.
That was all.
Yeah.
Pretty quiet, phony war.
Yes.
And then, of course, we got the orders in May. It was during May. I'd have to get one of those books down, have a look, see what they did.
Yes.
Then went up to Dover and on to Dunkirk. After that, we went to Cherbourg and took a lot of troops. No, we didn't go to Cherbourg. You know, to Cherbourg at first. We went to St. Malo. Supposed to be troops there. When we got there, we had to wait a long time, waiting outside, nothing happened. And they eventually got contact. The word came out, there's no troops here. Go back to Cherbourg. So we went to Cherbourg, and the crowds there, they were demoralized, there's no doubt about that. Because a lot of them left their weapons on the quayside. Just dropped them, got on board.
When they got on board, where did they go in the ship?
Oh, wherever, in the passenger accommodation,
yeah.
Right down below into the lounges and up top lounges and on the on the shelter deck and some up and amongst the lifeboats as well.
And if you were to go amongst them, was it very quiet or were they speaking?
I never really noticed. No, never noticed. When I had to go and watch, I had a cabin up on the upper deck, where the lifeboats were there, but there were cabins up there as well. And the top lounge was there. There wasn't much talk amongst them. They were dead tired too. They left, I said, these anti-tank rifles, which weren't much good anyhow. They left those behind as well.
So, following your trip to Dunkirk and then St. Malo and then Cherbourg, you only must have had another month or so left before...
Yes, after that, we went round to Liverpool and we loaded prisoners of war. And we took them up to the Clyde. And they were then transferred to the liners and the Clyde. For transshipment to Canada. Did you ever see a film called The 49th Parallel?
No.
I think that's shown again. I'm not too sure. But it was a story of a German prisoner of war escaped from the camp in Canada and was trying to get to America. And the main frontier between Canada and America is on the 49th parallel. The latitude, you know. So that's where it got its name from. I think he just made it, I'm not sure now. It's a long time since I seen it too, in the 1950s. But I was reading about it the other day.
Were the prisoners heavily guarded that you took?
Well, not when they came on board, not heavily guarded. I mean, where they were going, there's no point in trying to escape.
Yeah.
The long swim. From what I learned later on, when I was in the Navy, I met a chap. We were taking him back from France. He'd been free in France, wandering around. He got away, but the Germans never got him. But he said when the German troops got to the coast of Dover and whatnot, they were amazed. Oh, the sea, hadn't seen it before. Never seen the sea in their lives, you see, most of them.
Oh my goodness.
Eh? See the sea.
Why did you leave the Merchant Navy?
I left the Merchant Navy because I was given a chance to get on something that could hit back. There she is. And I thought, well, this has had enough of sitting on something that, well, all they had was a couple of Lewis guns and they had a grenade thrower on the back. They never used it because it was more dangerous to the ship than it was to a plane.
Yeah.
Well, it usually fell back on board. But we were given the option of staying with the Tyndall, the engineers, or leaving her. So I thought, oh gosh, yes, this will do me, get into something that can hit back. And only the chief engineer and myself stayed.
And so you joined the Royal Navy? You joined the Royal Navy?
I joined the Royal Navy. They were on articles called T-124X. They were guaranteed you your pay that you were getting as an engineer officer in the Merchant Navy. And they still give you the rank of officer, so I was a sub-lieutenant R&VR.
Now we've changed the tape. Why did you leave the Merchant Navy? Because you left in 1939. No.
I left when Tyndall went into Portsmouth
in
1942. I can't remember the actual date, whether it's June or July, it most likely was. And as I say, there were only two of us volunteered to remain with her. As a matter of fact, my friend Tom Cannell was one who didn't stay. And as I say, I got 42 shillings a week, and I think the chief engineer would get more than that. I'm not sure he did, but I had good digs. They were good. And the landlady was very good to me. And I was a fellow residence there was one was Colonel Brown, Royal Marines. He was a staff officer, a real gentleman. Mr. Adams, he was Lieutenant R&R engineer. He'd been on the cruiser Fiji when she got torpedoed, and he was now ashore in Portsmouth Dockyard in charge of the torpedo shop. Anyhow, very good. They taught me to play poker, a farthing a chip. You can lead, you lose 5 shillings a night on that if you're unlucky. And with your pay, which wasn't all that much, you had to watch it. So they were. It was really good. Bob Smith, he was the best man at my wedding because I got married down in Portsmouth. My wife comes from Portsmouth. She was in the Wrens then. So that went on for 18 months, and then we went out on trials.
This is in the Royal Navy?
In the Royal Navy, yes. And first time they did any gun trials, they only shot the tug that was towing the target. There was something wrong between the what you call gun directory and the guns themselves, so that had to be rectified. And Tynwald had something in 1942. 1, 2, 3 radar sets, and the majority of the Navy didn't have that. And one was long range, could pick up bombers at 90 miles, tell their height, speed, and direction. The other one was a gunnery director, and the smaller one was a surface radar. They called them RDF in those days. And they reckoned that could pick up a bottle or a periscope a good few miles away.
What was the name of the ship?
Hmm?
What was the name of the ship?
Tynwald.
Oh, I thought that was the Merchant Navy ship.
She was a Merchant Navy ship originally.
And she became a Royal Navy ship?
Yeah, she retained her name.
Ah.
Got a bit of a nuisance in Portsmouth Dockyard. They were getting the Tynwald's mail mixed up with the Tyndale.
Yes.
So then we went up.
Just for clarity, so that you were in the Merchant Navy on that boat, and that boat was sent to Portsmouth to refurbish it for the Royal Navy.
Converted into a anti-aircraft escort vessel.
Yes. And there so you went with it?
I went with it, yeah.
And that's why for 18 months it wasn't sailing, because it was being...
I had the job then of overhauling the machinery, not the main machinery, but the pumps.
Yes.
All the pumps, well, the equipment for pumping the oil into the burners and the boiler, that they were pumps as well, they had to be overhauled. So I had that job. Mm. And it took me all the time. I passed away quite nicely. And old Mr. Vickers, the chief engineer, he was good. He was, if anything I wanted to know, he put me right. So we were all quite happy down there. Except when the bombing came over, there was a house just up about 100 yards up the road from us, Ice Infesting Road in South Sea. A row of 3 houses, nice houses. The centre house was taken right out. The other 2 were left. And the blast blew the pantry window in and out, the house I was in. And there was no light then, but all the electric light was out, off and everything. Yeah. And we were down in the cellar. And it's a funny thing. The landlady's daughter had come up from Weymouth with her two children to get away from the bombing because they'd made a beeline at the Weymouth because it was these torpedo boats headquarters. They were rather nasty to the German inshore shipping. But you get a rest. And poor old Colonel Brown, he wasn't an old man either, he was to me, he was in his 40s and I was in 20. I was off with lumbago, backache, and we had two mattresses down at the bottom of the stairs going to the cellar. Well, there was a cellar under the dining room and a cellar under the front room, on the other side were a coal bunker and a coke bunker. But this was the best place to be. So we were all lying on this, Colonel Brown, Adams, I think, the landlady's daughter and her two children. And I was a poor fellow that was on the join between the two mattresses. Every time I wanted to turn because of the mattresses were hurting, everybody else had to turn. But I got up and heard a clash in the kitchen. I went upstairs to see what was happening. Two big meat dish covers that were hanging on pins on the wall had come off. And then we had a candle stuck at the bottom banisters for light. Mm. And I went upstairs to see everything was all right up there. It was two stories up. And coming down the stairs, I could see smoke. I said, what in that spot? I went into the lounge, and they had a fire in there. Only a small fire, but the soot had been blown down the chimney. Mm. And it had come out on the hearth, and it was taking fire and smoking.
Can you tell me about your first trip when the boat had was ready?
We're ready. Yeah. Well, we went from Portsmouth, stopped at Plymouth overnight. Some of the crew that were engineers that were on her now had come from the Esperance Bay. She was an armed merchant cruiser which was being returned to the merchant service because they were getting short of something to transport meat. She was a fridge ship. And they'd been in Plymouth, but they hadn't been in Plymouth when the bombs came down. And when they went ashore in Plymouth, they didn't recognize the place. An awful mess, but Portsmouth was the same. And we went from there round Land's End. And as we went round Land's End, we were attacked by a couple of German planes. But they must have got frightened because the gunnery wasn't so good, but they frightened them off. And went up the Clyde, and from there we went out on trials, anti-submarine trials off Iona, and trials as well there. We're coming in to Tobermory at night for anchorage. But I learned at that time why Scots people use salt with their porridge, because some nights we'd go up a loch far enough up it's considered safe, and there'd be a croft on the shore, a stream coming down from the hillside, and it was the stuff that brought down, that's what they were living on is for their cattle and whatnot. They're that far from any habitation that they couldn't get much sugar. Had to save the sugar with salt. Oh gosh, yes. We were not so long up there, and then we came down and into Belfast Lock, anchored there, and then we went out and met a convoy, and we brought some merchant ships out of the lock with us, and we went down to Milford Haven, and brought them in there, and some we brought down to the Bristol Channel. Most of them we brought down to Bristol Channel. And once we went round, oh no, I'll tell you another tale before I get to that. Once we were bringing ships up into the Bristol Channel, and one of the ships was a tanker, and this tanker had a catapult aircraft on board. Well, it was something to see this thing taken off. He was taken off now to fly to a RAF aerodrome. And rocket assisted. Now this is a tanker. I don't know whether it was petrol or just fuel, but the flame out of the thing, and it goes up the ramp, takes off. And now this boy, he'd seen two escorting aircraft coming with us up the channel, and they'd broken rules because they dropped down low and went flying past us when they should have stayed at a given ceiling. Anyhow, now this lad's going to show his mates on the ship how he can handle a plane. And he came down past the plane and around the stern, up, came down a second time, and right around the stern, nearly touching the stern of it. And came down the third time, and somebody said, he'll have it yet. And he came round, and he got up, and he couldn't get out of the vertical position of wings vertical. The wingtip touched the waves, and that was him.
Say that again, sorry, I missed that.
His wingtip touched the...
Oh, his wingtip touched the...
The waves.
The waves.
That's the finish of the plane. Oh. Right down. And it's the only time I ever saw them launch a ship's whale, a Navy whaler, while the ship was underway. And they launched it this time. And when she got down nearly to the water, the coxswain shouted, slip, and the... Two seamen, one at the forward blocks and the one at the after one, just strikes the blocks, and the blocks open and lets the boat drop. Mm. And she's underway too. He's got his tiller hard over, and she shoots away from the ship without banging against the side.
And,
there was a green spot in the water, and in the middle of that spot there was a head. That's the pilot. And he had what was inflatable life jackets, he just pulls them. And he was welcomed aboard without a sound. Everybody says, lost a bloody good aircraft, and we're short of him. I dare say he got he got the rounds of the table when he got in for whatever aerodrome he was going to.
When you had to escort a convoy, Was that just one Royal Navy ship?
One Royal Navy ship. Sometimes there was a Hunt class destroyer.
And your job was to use your guns if necessary, if you were under attack?
If there was any aircraft attacking, yes, use that.
But you wouldn't be able to do anything with the U-boats though, would you?
Yes, we were laden with the first commanding officer we had was a Commander Peters. Captain Peters, rather, DSO with bar, DSC with bar from the First World War, and a red-hot anti-submarine man, and this ship was chock-a-block full of depth charges, and he had his own method of loading the depth charge throwers, which was very quick, and, we did a lot of... anti-submarine work in that respect. There was a submarine worth of Iona. We didn't drop any depth charges on him, but the Aztec lads had to have some training on picking submarines up and all that. So that's the way he come. But we didn't depth charge him. They only went to practice of depth charging, throwing the depth charges over. My God, he used to Jake the ship to, and the ship would be going full speed. But
were ever any of the Merchant Navy ships that you were in convoy with torpedoed?
Not while we were there. The Nazi place was just on the approaches to Ireland and up towards Greenland. They had they could read the naval code. And they didn't know at the time that the British Navy or the British intelligence could read their codes, the Enigma code. So we brought Cunarder up the channel to Portsmouth. And she'd been an AMC, and she was going back to be converted into a Royal Navy workshop, Royal Fleet Auxiliary workshop. Mm-hmm. And funnily enough, after the Tynwald was sunk, I was sent out to Canada, to America, to join an escort carrier, one of the American carriers. And the senior engineer on her, not the engineer officer, senior engineer, was the world Cunard men. Forget his name now, and I said, well, he was quizzing me one day, and I said, well, did you know Tom Kameen? Yes, sir, you know Tom. He said, Tom Kameen was the short engineer in charge of Cunard in New York at the time. Do you know him? I said, yes, he's married to a second cousin of mine. What? Do you know Marjorie? They all knew her. Yeah. And she lived in Neston at the time.
Were you at sea when you found out the war had ended?
Yes. At that time I was on the finest ship I was ever in my life. I didn't last long in the in these. Oh dear, here. Yeah. Searcher? No, it wasn't Searcher. Something like that. I can't remember now. Because I started getting headaches again. I had headaches in the Tynwald, but it was due to a motorcycle accident I'd had in 1938. I went through the side of a bread van when I was going to night school. I wasn't going hard. It was engineering drawing, and I wasn't keen on engineering drawing. And I had a fractured skull right down here. But also, the impact had twisted my neck muscles as well, and they'd gone solid and hard on the nerves. The doctor and the Tynwald could manage to deal with them, but we went into Chatham. Stalker it was, HMS Stalker, to be brought up to to Royal Naval standards. The Yanks were awful mad about that. The ships weren't getting back to sea quick enough for their liking. And I reported to the doctor about these, and he sent me up to the Royal Naval Hospital for an examination. And there they said to me, well, go back and get your gear, you'll be here for a weekend. And then they said, you better get all your gear, you're here for longer than that. And I told them what had happened, the doctor on the Tynwald had managed it. But anyhow, I had to go under physiotherapy, and it was massage and electrical heat to the neck. And it was a male masseur there, and first time I went up, and I got this heat, and then he came to massage me. And he got the face between his hands, and he went, oof, oof. And you could hear the muscles cracking as they released, three cracks. Ooh, that's good. Went from there to Mount Vernon Hospital in Northwood. A lot worse than me there. There was a naval hospital, an army and navy and air force hospital. And when I went into the physiotherapy department, I had a look around there and said,